State Affairs is called to order. It is March the 11th. It is 9:20. Present for the record are Senators Bundy, French, and McGuire. We have four items on the agenda today. First up is Senate Bill 296, Crime Victim Compensation Fund, by myself. And Trevor, you want to come up and explain? When the committee heard this last, there was a recommendation that more direction be given to the Violent Crimes Compensation Board to encourage its efforts to pursue the revenues. And so in response to that, a letter of intent has been drafted. It's before the members now. So the question would be if it's satisfactory to members, and so perhaps a motion to adopt the letter of intent to follow along with the bill would be in order.
So moved, Madam Chair.
Okay, is there an objection to that? Okay, hearing and seeing none, then the letter of intent is adopted. That brings us back to Senate Bill 296 itself. Is there committee discussion or a motion?
Move. We move from committee with individual recommendations, attached fiscal notes, and attached letter of intent, Senate Bill 296.
Okay, is there an objection to that motion? Hearing and seeing none, Senate Bill 296 with the letter of intent, individual recommendations, and attached zero fiscal note has moved. Next, we have House Bill number 15 by Representative Seaton. When we last left off, we were in the middle of a motion, that motion being the adoption of Amendment number 1, K2. And there was an objection noted by Senator Green. So procedurally, we have the amendment before us in committee discussion. And before we adopt the proposed CS by the bill's sponsor, let's go back to Amendment 1 and have that discussion, which was whether or not we would incorporate the Board of Agriculture and Conservation into the conflicts bill. So does everybody have their old Amendment 1, or should we take a brief at ease and have that distributed?
I've got it.
Have it? Okay, so what I'd like to hear from the committee is strong wishes either way. Bryce Wrigley is on the line from the Farm Bureau. And Bryce, maybe you want to just refresh our memory about why you think it is important to have the Board of Agriculture and Conservation as a part of House Bill 15. Bryce, are you there? Not there. Okay. Well, does the committee have any strong feelings about it?
Madam Chair.
Yes. Senator French.
I think I and I imagine the rest of the committee received a memo from the bill sponsor dated March 7th. And I read it last night in preparation for today's hearing, and I was fairly persuaded by the third paragraph in that memo that points out, and I'll just state for the record what it says so we build a good record. The memo notes that the primary function of the Board of Agriculture is to authorize loans from the Agricultural Revolving Loan Fund. By statute, the majority of appointed members of the Board of Agriculture must be involved in commercial production agriculture. Currently, the Board of Agricultural members must recuse themselves when dealing with a loan that affects a direct competitor. Access to proprietary financial information is integral to these loan deliberations. The amendment to HB 15 would allow members to deliberate on issuance of a loan to a direct business competitor and to view their proprietary information. The memo goes on to point out that unlike the Board of Agriculture, the Board of Fisheries is charged with enacting a multitude of fisheries management regulations and has nothing to do with authorizing loans. I think that's kind of mm-hmm. a key difference mm-hmm. to help me at least make a decision on the amendment.
Okay, and so procedurally, Senator Green, you had objected to amendment number 1, which was the amendment that would have put the Board of Agriculture in. So if you want to maintain your objection, or if you want to remove it, and I will simply withdraw amendment number 1.
Okay, I'll remove my objection.
Okay, and I'll withdraw amendment number 1. So now that brings us to the CS, which is /L. For House Bill number 15, is there a motion to adopt the CS?
So moved.
So moved. Any objection to the motion?
Just for the purposes of discussion, Madam Chair.
Okay.
What's different about the CS than what we saw last week?
Representative Seaton.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator French, the only change is on page 2, line 16. After this bill had passed through the House, there had been a change in other laws, and it had changed so that now the current bill talks about 120F, which actually talks about political use of state aircraft. And so the citation is confusing to people when they read the bill and says we're repealing something about state aircraft, which has no meaning. So all this does is say that we're looking at the right section of the bill. So that's simply a change.
Okay, does everybody understand that explanation? Okay, any further discussion on this committee substitute? Okay, hearing and seeing none, there are folks online to answer any questions. Steve Doherty with the AG, Brian Kane with Ledge Legal. And then the only other person who I have signed up that would not be just to answer questions, Ricky Geese in Kenai. Ricky, are you there?
He's back here.
Right.
Oh. Okay, great. So is there anybody else in the audience that wishes to testify on the new CS on House Bill 15? Or anybody else online? Okay, hearing and seeing none, then public testimony on the CS is closed. It brings it back before us for committee discussion or a motion. Senator Green.
I've received concerns on this because, and I want to try to get this all together, and I may get Ricky to come up and talk about the concerns expressed by some of the folks on this as the it leaves people with a vested interest on the board for purposes of discussion. And we talked about the other day how important that is. They're not recused from the discussion, only from the final vote. And so,
or does this give them the vote? This allows.
Do they have voting rights on this?
Madam
Just
Chair,
yeah.
Senator Green, if they have a financial conflict of interest, they may not vote, but they could discuss.
Mm-hmm. Deliberate.
And in this particular board, there's no second chance for the public to reappear and refute what someone may have said or counter it or have an opposing opinion. And so, and for that reason, I probably won't be supporting this bill and would, you know, object to it passing out of committee.
Okay. Are there any changes, Senator Green, that you think could be made to, it's just the concept.
The whole purpose of the bill is to allow them to discuss it, is it not?
Through the chair, Representative Green, yes, to bring their expertise to the Board of Fish and to allow them to participate in deliberations, but not to vote. There are two parts of the bill. One is the deliberation, and the other part is changing the definition of family so that it's the same as we use in the legislature, meaning the immediate family instead of extended family, including grandparents and aunts and uncles. So there are two sections to the bill.
Okay. Senator Bundy had his hand up first, then Senator Stevens. Senator Stevens.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. I just want to point out that former Representative Tillian testified and told us that when he was the fisheries czar under Governor Hammond, he thought it was important that the area M issue be addressed, and he was able to get two people appointed, one from either side of area M, to debate the issue. When the issue came before the board, both of them were sitting in the hallway and they could not participate. The two people that knew something about the issue could not participate. That's really the service to everyone. If you let everyone participate who knows nothing about the area, and those who do know something about it, you put them in the hallway so they can't be a part of the discussion. So I think it's a good idea. I approve the bill. I think it should pass.
Okay. Further committee discussion, Senator Green.
Yeah, and you know, and it's been a long time since I've been to a fishery board of fish meeting. But I still say that the discussion portion of the meeting is so critical and cannot be refuted by anyone in the audience. And if you don't happen to have someone who knows the countervailing opinion to this person who has a, quote, we'll call it a vested interest or a, you know, considerable knowledge interest or whatever, and a financial interest, then you can't get a balanced viewpoint. Now, if they would open up the discussion again, which they're not going to do, it might be different. But I think it works, and there must be some way that it can be worked out without putting them back in the discussion, without allowing any, if there doesn't happen to be a member on the board who knows the other side of the story on that particular issue, then you can't receive the information from anyone in the audience.
Representative Seaton, had you thought about, in looking at the way that the board goes through its deliberations, allowing after the deliberations and the conflicted members' discussion, opening it back up again for public comment?
Thank you, Madam Chair. You know, I'm not, this bill isn't meant to get into the technical details of how the board decides to conduct its business. Right now what happens is a full pile of issues come before the board, and then they're assigned to committees, and they'll have two or three members of the board who may or may not know anything about that subject go with anyone from the public who wishes to discuss that. And so they break up into committees and discuss in detail with full public participation in that, with those two or three committee members or board members. Then when they come back to the table after all these separate working groups, or they call them committees, then they come back and make a recommendation to the board. The board is already at that time, I believe they took public testimony first. It could be that it's after the committee process, then they take the public testimony, you know, like we do 3 minute public testimony, uh-huh. 5 minute. And then it goes into committee deliberations, just like you're having right now. And when the committee is deliberating, they can ask questions of other folks, they can bring the department back up, they can call in at ease and go out and ask somebody. What happens in this process is that anybody that has one of the conflict of interests leaves the table. So if it was one of you, you would leave the room, basically, and would not be involved in the deliberation process at all. So that's basically the context of the way the board works. I'm sure we have somebody from the board here that could probably give you a much more detailed explanation.
Okay, that would be great.
Madam Chair and
good morning.
Committee members, I'm Jim Marcotte, the Board of Fisheries Executive Director, so I was not actually promoted to the board. I'm their lead staff person. But the question is, could the steps at a board meeting be changed to allow additional public comment?
You've heard Senator Green's concerns expressed, and I'm just trying to think if there's a way, while we're at it, while we're speaking to the board's process and changes that should be made, is there another step that could be put in that would allay her concerns?
Madam Chair, it is possible for the board to change the steps in their meeting, and that's not dictated by statute. The board's free to change how they set up their meeting agenda. There are three opportunities for public comment. It includes the sign up for oral public testimony, and that takes place at the beginning of the meeting. And then there's this committee process.
Senator Green,
is the sign up at the beginning for oral testimony, is that directed at a special issue that's already on the agenda, or is it to bring forth a fact that someone might not know?
Madam Chair, Senator Green, it's open for all of the items that are before the board at that meeting.
Thank you.
Okay.
Madam Chair. Then during the committee process, there's ample time for public involvement there, because you have these public panel members and two or three board members in these committees. And they'll spend maybe up to a day going through a list of a couple of dozen proposals. And so each proposal gets a very thorough review at that time, and they explore if there's compromises that could be made, or amended proposals that could be used. they determine if there's a consensus on a proposal or not. And then
Jim, our non-public panel, our members of the, our non-members of the panel allowed to testify or requested, in, do they request information from them at that time? Or is it just among the panel?
Well, through the chair, it's primarily through the panel members, but those committee meetings are generally run on a New England town hall style meeting format. So in most all cases, the board members are fairly liberal about including any discussion that if somebody has a burning issue or if they're the expert or if they're going to be directly affected, in almost all cases, the board members will allow that person to speak. So it is very open and free for that public discourse at that point. And then the final public comment checkpoint is responding to the written committee report. Those reports are presented, we set those out, and then there's a period of maybe a half day to a couple of days where the public can respond to those written reports, no longer in oral testimony, but certainly in written testimony. And it's a common practice to catch board members in the hallway or during breaks and share concerns. So there's lots of opportunity for that public input. But it is true that once the board begins the deliberations, that they tend not to invite the public back to the table to engage in the final deliberation.
Senator Green?
And who might be, with, is that the point at which the department would be at the table? Would the, I mean, answer questions if anyone of the board members had questions, or is it just a discussion among board members?
Through the chair, yes, the department is at the table, and the department can be viewed as the staff for the board. The board doesn't have a staff of expertise. We have a small staff for the technical mechanics of the meeting. But the department as a whole is available to field questions. Similarly, the enforcement concerns are represented through Captain Al Kane, who's at the table. And then the Department of Law is also present. So the board does have resources available to answer questions.
Thank you.
Thank you. Further questions? Senator Stevens.
Madam Chair, I'm not sure I really have a question here, but I did attend board meetings for about 5 years when I was involved in the fishing industry, and it seemed to me at the time everyone knew everyone else's business. We knew the financial, personal investment that everyone had on the board and how they were involved. So I guess my concern is, or my question of you is, if we were to pass this bill, would you see it in any way dangerous? Is it giving too much power to a member of the board who may have a personal or financial interest, and so that they could abuse the public and vote their own interest and not the best interest of the industry?
Through the chair, Senator Stevens, excellent question. I will qualify that the department has not taken a position on this, and similarly, the board as a whole has not acted to develop a position on this. In informal discussions, the board members, by and large, are comfortable with this. They do feel that their ability to participate has been infringed in certain instances. The question of whether or not this would be potentially harmful or damaging, I guess it's either, well, it's in my belief that it would not be, or, and I think that's the consensus view of the board, that it would not be damaging. It's not seen as a sweeping change because of the limitation on the voting, but to allow discussion, to participate in the discussion, is seen as a positive step. And then also the in a sense the narrowing of the definition of family. Right now it's the administrative branch definition is fairly broad, but to switch over to the legislative branch definition narrows it some, and that's seen as a sort of a minor change. It would be beneficial to the board in that sense. But the checks and balances of any board member really in their promoting their own interest, those checks include the chairman ruling somebody out of line, fellow board members calling them on it, and their risk of getting crosswise with the broader public groups out there. So I think it would be very unlikely somebody would be acting that directly in their self-interest and not in the interest of the greater state concerns.
Madam Chairman?
Yes.
I appreciate his comments, but I think that since neither the department nor the board has taken a stand on this, that I would consider those his personal comments.
Fair enough. Okay, thank you. Ricky Geese, do you want to offer your testimony on the bill? I'll reopen it. You can offer it, and then we'll close up here.
Hi, my name is Ricky Geese. I'm the executive director of Kenai River Sport Fishing Association. I attend a lot of Board of Fisheries meetings, both in Cook Inlet and around the state. I do think this bill, there's two components to it. I think when you hear testimony about the number of board members being conflicted out of issues, I think that has to look at financial concerns. This bill does a good job in terms of the legislative stuff because it actually lasers it in if you personally have a financial interest. And I think that's a very good portion of this bill, and I think that should go forward. I do have a concern about allowing people after public testimony. The board is set up so that there's plenty of opportunity for board members, if they're conflicted out on an issue, to talk to other board members. If you're a member of the board, just like you trust your colleagues, you go say, hey, what's the issue on this? But in front of, when you're in a public process and you're asking for the public to trust an unbiased opinion on a decision, and you have somebody up there with a financial interest, a personal financial interest, and you may say, we're just getting information, but you can direct staff and department staff through questioning and through the absence of questioning on certain issues. You can, I'm not going to say manipulate the process, but you can make sure that your side of the argument is better represented up there. And I think that board members may not see that as a problem at this point, but I do think it will diminish the trust that user groups have in that board process, because currently right now all user groups are on equal standing. You can go up there and you can say your share, and you're in front of an unbiased board members, and if somebody had a direct financial conflict, they're not part of that deliberation. So I think that there's trust in the Board of Fisheries process right now. And I think there's plenty of the process works to get all the information out there for people to deliberate about. I really haven't seen too many times where there isn't information. And where there isn't information or you need new information, the board's very good at saying, time out, we need a 5-minute break, we need to discuss this. Where's the information so that all board members have that information? So I think what you want is to ensure that the public, when they leave a Board of Fisheries meeting, is they may not like a decision. They may have an allocation may have turned one way or another, and you can vent your, you know, disagreement with that. But you want to make sure that when the public leaves that process, they feel that the process itself was a good process and that it was unbiased. And I just, and you know, you could put people on the board. You want the public to leave feeling good about the process, that all the information was heard and was all public. And then it's up to the other board members to deliberate about that. But I do think you're putting, you're tainting the process by putting a person in deliberation with a direct financial interest in it. So.
Thank you for your comments. Okay, we're going to go ahead and hold House Bill 15 over. Thank you, Representative Seaton. Next, we have Julie Lucky. Do you want me to bring up Hawkers or wait till he comes back?
That'd be up to you, Madam Chairman. If you'd like me to present the bill, I'm perfectly happy to do that. If you'd like to wait.
Who's the other? Let's see here. Oh, Senator Wilikowski. You're in the room. Why don't we do Senator Wilikowski's? Just he's here, and then we'll see if Mike comes back. Senate Bill 278. This is the Veteran Information on permanent fund dividend applications. Tell us about the bill.
Great. Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, for the record, my name is Bill Wilkowski. I'm the state senator for Northeast Anchorage. SB 278 is a bill that helps the state and veterans groups find and provide services for Alaska veterans. The bill is quite simple in application. It asks a question on the permanent fund dividend. Are you an American military veteran? It's a strictly a voluntary decision by the person whether or not to check that. By offering the option of identifying themselves as veterans, we can help those veterans and their families to access federal programs and benefits that they've earned. This bill stems from underutilized veterans services in the state with about 75,000 veterans and 26,000 National Guard members, reserves, and active duty personnel across the state. Alaska has, as you know, the highest per capita number of veterans in the nation. The retirement checks and benefits Alaskan veterans receive contribute more than $1 billion to our economy every year. Benefits received include VA health care, burial rights, disability compensation, survivor benefits, housing loans, spousal assistance, college assistance, and vocational assistance. However, only 1 in 5 veterans receive these benefits. If we could increase this, double it perhaps, the number of veterans receiving these benefits, Alaska would help many additional families. And this would also create a significant economic boost to communities across the state. We believe this bill will bring in millions of dollars from the federal government into Alaska. The intent of this legislation is to enhance our list of known veterans in the state. DMVA should keep the list and allow access to the list to congressionally chartered and state-approved veterans groups to use for the purpose of informing veterans of their entitled benefits. This bill attempts to reach those veterans who, for whatever reason, are not currently receiving their benefits. Ask your support in this legislation. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Questions for the bill sponsor? Senator Green.
Okay, and this is not mandatory.
Do
other states have applicable, I mean, they don't all have permanent fund applications, but do they have it through licensure or?
For the record,
my name's Kat Puste. I work for Senator Wilkowski. Sorry, I have a cold. You know, I'm not sure about that, but I can check on it for you.
Thank you.
Through the chair. Thank you. Sorry.
Okay, very good. Thank you.
Senator Bundy?
All right. Do we have somebody from the Permanent Fund Corporation to testify? Questions for them?
Jerry Burnett's here.
Burnett. Okay, good. He's not signed up. So he'll wait.
Well, the question I'd have for Senator Wilkowski is, I assume you chose the PFD because probably everybody's involved in that. But wouldn't driver's license also be an option for reaching these people?
That's another option. And again, it's just everybody collects a permanent fund. Not everyone has a driver's license. So,
okay, thank you.
Okay, thank you, Senator Wilkowski.
Thank you.
We have, why don't we start with Jerry Burnett and then go to the four people that are online. Good morning. Welcome to Senate State Affairs.
Good morning. For the record, my name is Jerry Burnett. I'm the Administrative Services Director, Ledge Liaison for the Department of Revenue, and I'm just here to answer questions. So,
okay, Senator Bundy.
This is obviously a well-intentioned bill, but we have seen cases before, like PFD checkoff well-intentioned bills that Christmas tree up and become a real burden to the department. I'm just wondering if there are unintended consequences that might occur. Can you imagine other mining of data that might be expected of the Permanent Fund Corporation? Because as the sponsor pointed out, that everyone applies for PFD. We could, if you need housing assistance, how's your health care, on and on and on.
Through the chair, Senator Bundy, the Permanent Fund Dividend Division provides information to any state government agency or federal government agency, the university, at their request. So to the extent that we collect that data now, it's not an issue. The difference with this is it requires that we ask for some additional information, and that's why we have a small fiscal note on here, because we have to redesign the form. We have to redesign the online application, and then we have a little bit of extra work going on as a result of this. It's not a huge amount of work. I don't see that this would create any issues of the type that you're concerned about.
Okay, thank you. And Mike, just for just the logistics, a veterans group would have to query you, and then you would provide a, some kind of, I suppose, online information as to the people who had indicated yes.
Through the chair, Senator Bundy, as I understand the bill and the intent of the sponsor is that we would provide this information to the Department of Military and Veterans Affairs in a format that would allow them to share it with the veterans organizations. It does provide in the bill as written that we could provide it directly to the veterans organizations, but I think it works much more efficiently if we provide it to the Department of Military and Veterans Affairs, and they and they're providing it on. We're collecting this information. It's you know, the year of service, the years of service, the branch of service, etc., and it's fairly simple once it's in there.
And
Senator Bundy,
and isn't that information available from the federal government? That's still have a copy of my DD-2 form.
Through the chair, Senator Bundy, I'm not one of the people who came out with the idea of doing this bill, but my understanding from testimony in the other body is that there's no way to know when people move to Alaska, and this would allow you to know where these people live who are members.
Excuse me. It's your DD-2 form.
Yeah. What uncle? I don't have any Uncle Sam. My apologies. So if a veterans group wanted to, they could query the federal government. This is just cutting out a step.
To the chair, Senator Bundy, I believe if they queried the federal government may or may not know the last address of these people, because you don't track your veterans for any particular purpose.
All right. Thank you.
Senator Green.
Does this bill need an effective date?
To the chair, Senator Green, I don't believe so, because it would go into effect 90 days after passage, and this wouldn't obviously be effective until the 2009 application. So we'd be, as soon as we knew this bill had passed, we'd go ahead and redesign the application forms for next year.
It's the application people fill out in 2009.
Right, and so for the 2008 dividend, so which is filled out in 2009.
And there's no confusion.
No.
Thank you.
I don't believe so.
Senator Stevens?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Does the Department of Military Veterans Affairs communicate with veterans? I'm a veteran, but I've never heard from anybody, and they're probably under the radar, but do they send you out like information so you know what benefits are? Like burial rights. I never thought about that, but someday.
Through the chair, Senator
Stevens.
Think
about it more often
than
you do.
Yes,
right. There are people online.
I'm not like from the Department of Military and Veterans Affairs. I don't know if they're online, and they could probably answer that question.
Thank you.
Thank you. Anything further for Mr. Burnett?
Yes.
Senator Bundy.
Well, and in light of other things we've talked about, there are some people who are very concerned about their privacy. And as Senator Green said, this would be an option, so people have had enough of the military and don't want anybody bugging them. Your item on the form, would that indicate this is an option? You don't have to fill this out indicating yes or no you are a veteran.
Yeah, that's important.
Through the chair, Senator Bundy, yes, it absolutely would say that this is voluntary, both on the paper form and the online application. And we would not use veteran status in any way for eligibility. So we wouldn't be communicating with people and asking them to fill it in if they didn't fill it in correctly or if they were incomplete. That would be, we wouldn't be looking to them for any clarification.
Thank you very much. Okay, I'm going to go to the folks online. First, I have David Glenn in the MATSU with the Vietnam Veterans of America. Mr. Glenn?
Good morning. My name is Dave Glenn.
Good morning.
I'm a member of Vietnam Veterans of America 903 in Wasilla. 45 years ago, I enlisted in the U.S. Army. 43 years ago, at a time when I dare say some of you on this panel were probably more concerned about what you were going to wear to school than world affairs, my country sent me to Vietnam as a member of the 101st Airborne Division. I spent a year in the jungle watching my fellow soldiers sustain grievous injuries and death. Some still suffer today from physical and mental injuries sustained during combat. It's now reported that Vietnam veterans have a 10-year shorter lifespan and are five times more susceptible to ill health in their senior years than the average citizen. I come before you today not to request or beg. No, I come before you today to demand that SB 278 be immediately passed. The provisions of this bill will allow members of military service organizations to locate and render assistance to hundreds and hundreds and most likely thousands of veterans that have been ignored by the federal government for decades. The information derived from Senate Bill 278 will help us locate these veterans, and we can guide them through the process of collecting the benefits promised during their military service. So my understanding that this bill has been referred to a committee because of a ridiculous cost estimate attached by the Department of Revenue. This is a blatant attempt to kill this bill, and personally, I'm insulted that some bureaucrat thinks we're so dumb that we don't know what's happening. I've watched over the recent years as the political process has sunk to an all-time low in Alaska, elected representatives accepting bribes, others convicted of felonies and going to jail. I certainly hope that this panel has the guts to start the healing process and provide encouragement to the citizens by doing the right thing and reaching out to our veterans. Failure on your part to attain passage of this bill will be a tremendous mistake on your part and will only contribute to the overall conception of what a poor job our Alaska government is doing. And I'm respectfully yours, Dave Glenn.
Thank you, Mr. Glenn. Interesting style. Senator Bundy.
Well, I just want to thank you for your service, and I hope part of that service included the right to me for me to disagree with you without seeming to be un-American.
Well, sir, I didn't accuse you of being un-American. I accused my Alaska government of making me feel poorly about my Alaska government, and I'm in trying to encourage you through harsh words to get on the stick and get things done. If that bothers you, well, I'm sorry. But I've been pushed around. I've seen these veterans out here seeing hard times for decades. And it's time that we do something for them. Not yesterday, but right now.
Okay. Well, and just to clarify on the record as well, there isn't any fiscal note from the VA, just to be clear. The only fiscal note in here is from the Department of Revenue, which is required to do an analysis of how much it would cost to put this into the application. And so what you see is $16,000 which is nominal, but essentially to change the online database and application form so that that particular line in there can reflect that checkoff. So just to clarify that on the record.
Can we have a brief at ease?
Yes, we'll have a brief at ease. And next we're going to go to Maurice Bailey or Bally? My apologies.
Bailey,
okay. Good morning, sir.
Good morning. I'm Maurice Bailey. I'm the president of Veterans Aviation Outreach, and I'm also a 21-year veteran, three tours of Vietnam. I'm one of the founders of the Veterans Aviation Outreach. We have four airplanes and four pilots for the express purpose of finding some of these people, some of these veterans that are in these villages scattered throughout Alaska. And at this time, we have no way of finding vets scattered throughout Alaska, and many are not aware of the available benefits. And we cannot afford to do what is not right by our veterans, and eventually this is going to catch up with us in the form of a substandard armed forces. At this time, we're scraping the bottom of the barrel to get recruits for our all-volunteer forces. And the reason being is the way we treat our vets. To pass this bill at this time is the right thing to do. The VA does not track these veterans, the armed forces or whoever don't track these guys once they leave the military. And like I said, I've been flying around Alaska for the last 25 years. And there's many, many people, not only do they don't know the benefits that are available, they don't even realize they're veterans. They think if they wasn't in a war, got nothing coming. And I think it's time for us to start looking out for our veterans because, you know, we don't want to wake up one of these mornings and we'll be sleeping in a dormitory next to the factory. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much for your testimony. Next, we'll go to Russell Kell. Mr. Kell, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Good morning.
Thank you very much for conducting this hearing.
You're welcome.
I represent the Vietnam Veterans of America, Chapter 904 in Anchorage. And I'd like to point out, first of all, that the amount of money that the Veterans Administration receives, the way it's allocated to the state of Alaska is based upon the veteran population. And that veteran population relates back to the census. And I was in the mid to late 80s an employee of the Veterans Administration, and I was their representative to the census at that time. And at that time, I questioned the way in which they were counting veterans. I explained my concern. They listened to me. They said that this would have been cleared up. Unfortunately for them, I was also chosen in that census as an interviewee by a census worker. And what I found is that their definition of veterans, in many cases, they may not be capturing veterans that are right now in our state. And that, in turn, affects that funding. Let's look at what that funding goes for. First of all, it goes for medical care, and it goes for preventative medical care. And what that means is if a person does not get that preventative medical care, subsequently, the medical care is going to be much more costly. And if the person is not recognized as a veteran or is not found eligible or entitled as a veteran to medical care, that means the state, in many cases, is going to be required to pay for this medical care through Medicaid. And this is a concern to me as a taxpayer in the state of Alaska. In terms of education, if these veterans aren't identified shortly after they get out of the service, the educational benefit will be of less use to them. The older a person is when they receive education, the less benefit that education is going to be to our society. So it's important that we capture these people as quickly as we can when they enter our state and when they leave the service. And the last thing I'd like to talk about is homelessness, okay? Without preventative medical care and without education, homelessness is going to increase. It has increased in our veterans population in the past. I see no reason that a percentage of our homeless will not continue to increase unless we are able to reach our veterans more quickly and more effectively. In order to do that, okay, we have to know who the veterans are. Relative to an earlier question, is this information available from the VA? I was, for a period of time, the release of information officer for both the Veterans Health Administration and the Veterans Benefits Administration in Anchorage. And let me assure you, without the veteran's signature, it's going to be very difficult for you to obtain an address of a veteran from the VA. Okay, so that's probably not going to happen. So the only thing I can say is, with what's happening with both state and federal budgets, I suspect that the VA in the future is going to attempt to share this expense with the state as they have other expenses. And the sharing with the state, okay, is going to depend upon how many veterans are in the state. So I would suggest that this is going to be beneficial to the state to have this information regardless of how it is or whether or not it's released. So they will have some handle on the number of veterans in their state and what the cost to the state of those veterans are. I would encourage you to allow this to be on the PFD application, but I would suggest that you be cautious on the release of this information and also that you explain to the veterans how this information will be released on the application so they will know how it will be released. Also, if it goes through the State Veterans Affairs Office, I would suggest that it be made available equally to all nationally chartered veterans organizations. Again, all nationally chartered veterans organizations would be very important if there's going to be any type of release at all. I conclude my testimony knowing that time is of the essence here, but I, again, let me say one more time, I do encourage you very much to pass this. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Kell. We've got a couple questions. I have one. When you talked about your work on the census, you described the problem of defining what a veteran was and how you didn't think that the right questions were asked or in some way the definition was not clear. In the bill itself right now, we simply have the mandate that on the form it will include a place for the applicant to voluntarily indicate that the applicant is a veteran. Do you think we need to make a series of questions or is there anything to make that more clear? Are we going to run into the same problem again where people don't know if they are or are not a veteran?
I think for the purposes of the state, when you use the word veteran, the primary misunderstanding is it means a person who's been separated from active duty. That is true. It does mean that. But it also means, in many cases, people who are on active duty but are also veterans because they have served a significant period of service and their service has been honorable. That's the primary fault I found when I was interviewed by the census person. But I think, you know, how you do that would be something you would decide. You could just use the word veteran. The other thing you could do is you could say, are you serving honorably or have you served honorably in the United States Armed Forces for a period of more than 180 days or 1 year or whatever you think would be the appropriate period for the purposes of the state of Alaska.
Okay, really quickly, Mr. Kell, on that second point. So the second class of veterans are individuals who have not necessarily been separated from active duty, but rather are on active duty but have served what period of time with honorable distinction? You're saying 180 days plus?
I think the last time I reviewed the Title 38, it was 180 days, and I don't believe that's changed.
Okay, we'll find out. Thank you very much. Senator Stevens has a question.
Actually, you asked my question, but maybe just one other issue of the issue of the impact of what we're doing here on the permanent fund. That will not have an impact on the actual count used through the census, will it? I mean, there's going to be no connection there. Is that right?
No. What it will do, it will give you a tool, okay? It will give the state of Alaska a tool, okay, to gauge the effectiveness of the census. And if it becomes a matter, as it is with VA medical care, of doling to the state and and programs that have joint participation, okay, it will give you a tool to determine whether or not you're getting what is actually the fair due for the state of Alaska. Unfortunately, some people have said that the Department of Veterans Affairs in Alaska, okay, may want to minimize the impact of the numbers because their evaluation is going to be based on what they do in terms of what the total population is, what percentage they're treating. And the total population, okay, that number is going to be very important both in determination of how well they're doing their job and in the future, I suspect, in determination of how much federal money is going to come to the state of Alaska.
Senator, question. Senator Bundy first, then Senator French.
Yeah, thank you. Of course, my dad was a member of the Greatest Generation, so I'm a little troubled by the notion that a veteran is defined as someone who is currently serving. Is there a federal definition of veteran? And at least my informal one is one who has served honorably and is now separated from the service. How can you be a veteran and continue to serve?
It's Title 38 of the United States Code. Okay. Section 101 is the federal definition of a veteran, and Title 38 is the law that relates to veterans' benefits within the United States.
Okay. Senator French.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This may be a question more for the bill sponsor rather than Mr. Kell, but I'm happy to have anyone answer it that can. And my question is this. Are there state benefits involved here, or are these strictly federal benefits? That is there any downside? Not that I would see a downside, but if you understand in the context of the question, is there going to be any cost to the state if we identify more veterans, or will we simply be doing a better job of directing federal benefits to individuals who may be lawfully entitled to them and morally entitled to them as well?
Sponsor of the bill, Senator Wilikowski.
Senator French, through the chair, the vast majority of the benefits are federal in nature. There may be some state benefits as well, and we can get an exact detail from DMV about what those are, but the vast majority will be federal benefits.
Does that answer your question?
That's my understanding. Well, I mean, I met with Mr. Davidge, who I know is one of the prime movers behind this bill, and he makes a very compelling case for the bill, and it struck me that was what I him, and I just want to get it on the record that, you know, it's going to be 10-1 or something. You know, if there are state benefits, you know, that's it's they're ancillary to the bulk of federal benefits that go to individuals who've served in the armed forces.
The particular ones that I can think of, I think we have a tuition benefit, and we have a we're in Senate Resources right now, we're dealing with a bill that would potentially make veterans eligible, or actually active members, I don't know if it even applies to veterans, eligible for lower cost hunting licenses.
Senator Bundy.
The discussion of this federal money that would flow in, and you know, there's some folks have made a compelling argument that identifying more veterans would be a win-win in that they get the services and the state gets the money. But I'm curious and a little concerned about where the money goes to. This federal money comes in, does it go to our military and vets department? Does it go to these other federally chartered organizations that were mentioned? Or does it go directly to the individual? I'm concerned about people, you know, fighting over victims.
Mm-hmm. And I think it depends on the specific type of benefit that we're talking about. For instance, if it's burial rights, then the veteran would be entitled, that money would go to the mortuary company. If it were GI benefits, that money would go directly to the university. If it were VA money, then the United States government, as we just heard, has the formula where it calculates how many veterans you have and then gives the state money for that. So I guess it depends on what the particular benefit is. Some would flow directly to the state. Others would flow directly to the person to be used for whatever benefit is being accrued.
Thank you.
Senator Green?
I'm just going to say that DMVA has issued a zero fiscal note. So I assume they don't feel like there's any expense accrued to them. And they would sort of be the ones overseeing.
Thank you for pointing that out.
Senator Stevens, then Bundy.
Just to point out, there's also a state a VA housing loan program, which is pretty widely used.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was just looking here in the statutes for what we define as a veteran, and it appears in multiple places depending on the state benefit. And in this case, this is the Alaska Housing Finance Corporation statutes, and we do give veteran benefits, and they do define veteran very differently than Mr. Kerr said earlier. So it's something to think about, but each individual benefit that is given defines veteran in a specific way. So, Senator Bundy.
And again, the PFD people are going to have to somehow indicate to the people who fill out that form what is a veteran, how is it defined? And the feds define it one way, we have different programs define it another. I think it'll be more than just a simple question. It'll have to explain what a veteran is. And I wanted to share with the bill sponsor that my support or opposition to this bill, in light of previous testimony, is not going to be based on a $32,000 fiscal note when we're dealing with billions, nor will it be affected by obnoxious testimony.
Thank you.
Good point. Senator Wilikowski, you might take a look at this since you're on this bill. I find it fascinating how many times you uncover a term and how inconsistently it is defined. So you're going to be holding out the term veteran, which we have already established has a differing meaning on the federal level from the state. But even as between the state definitions, just right here alone, I've uncovered two completely different definitions. And one includes actually the spouse, widow, or widower of a person. The other does not. And then the other is actually timed and linked to certain dates of wars. So you might take a look at that.
We'll take a look at it. And I guess my thought on that is I don't know that we, and maybe we do, but I don't know that we want to get too wrapped around the axle on the definition of a veteran, because we're sort of acting as a conduit, and we're saying if you deem yourself to be a veteran, then you may be eligible for certain benefits. And we're not giving you, we're not through this bill mandating that you're eligible or not,
right.
But we're merely saying to those organizations that are out there, hey, you can work with this person, and perhaps they are entitled to some sort of benefits. But we may want to put a definition, and I quite frankly had always considered Senator Bundy's definition to be the appropriate definition, but we'll be happy to look at the statutes and see.
Yeah, I think just the concern is you come right back to Mr. Kell's concern, which is the work that he did on the census, which is that there's some confusion, appears to be confusion as to who is in fact a veteran. So, Senator Stevens.
Well, just the issue of funding from the federal government to the state comes through the census information, and this has really no impact on that. This is totally separate. So maybe we can line numbers up and see, maybe we're not counting you, but really there is no connection through this, what we're doing here, with the amount of funds we get from the federal government, is there?
Well, and I guess, that's an interesting question. On the census, you can challenge, you can appeal a census decision by the federal government, is my understanding. So if you had, for instance, 150,000 veterans identify themselves on your permanent fund, and then the federal government says, well, wait a second, we only count you as having 75,000, I don't see why you couldn't go to the federal government and say, here's the proof, here's our data. Sure. So I think that probably could help us getting more federal funds.
I agree. Mm-hmm. Thank you, Senator Wilkowski. We've got four more folks to testify to our honorable veterans on the line. If I could ask you to be as concise in your testimony as possible, because I think the bill has a chance of moving today. We've got one other item on the agenda, so however brief you could be, that would be the committee would appreciate it. So, Ron Siebels?
Yes, Madam Chair. I'm Ron Siebels. I'm with the Military Order of the Purple Heart. This bill is going to enable us to reach out to those vets in remote areas who don't have easy access to the assistance that they earned. We can push that assistance easier from the major centers like Anchorage, Fairbanks, Juneau, places like that. We can push that assistance easier than they can extract it from out in the villages. The Military Order of the Purple Heart Department of Alaska, we want to go on record as being in full support of this bill. I think our problem in obtaining benefits is at the federal level. I think our state legislators are doing a real good job of trying to help veterans. I appreciate everyone's support on this, and I just want to say thanks. I think the state can help us obtain the federal benefits these guys earn by the military service. And we talk about veterans. To me, veterans, a guy enters a contract with the service. He puts on a uniform, and once he's gone out and he's earned his part of the contract, to me, that's where veteran status really begins. There's many interpretations, but that's kind of mine. And again, I just want to say thanks, and that concludes my testimony. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And, you know, we appreciate your thanks, and that's the kind of testimony that motivates people. Thank you very much. Tim Wheeler.
Madam Chair, I'm the Secretary of the Alaska Veteran Business Alliance, and I'm in contact with veterans throughout the state of Alaska. You would not believe how many veterans out there don't know what benefits or information that they need to know. With Senate Bill 278, this would bring the veteran population into one database to get required information to all veterans, whether it is updates or new legislation from the VA, or links to websites for all of us veterans to know. I ask you and the rest of your colleagues to pass this bill, because this is a necessity to keep all veterans informed. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Wheeler, and thank you for your service. Kevin McGee.
Good morning, Madam Chair and distinguished members of the committee. My name is Kevin McGee. I'm president of AFGE Local 3028. I represent all of the employees, the bargaining unit employees that work at the Department of Veterans Affairs. The effect of Senate Bill 278, I feel, will assist with identifying Alaska's most precious resource, Alaska's veterans, and AFGE Local 3028 is in complete support of this legislation. And hopefully you and your committee will support this legislation and continue its move forward. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. McGee. Mr. Raymond Reynolds.
Good morning, Madam Chair. I'm here. I'm with the American Legion Post 29 in Muldoon. If we can get this through, this is going to help a lot of the folks that are out there that are unidentified, even through a census. A lot of people don't get hit with the census at all because of their living status. Anything that's going to make things easier, I know I've tried to go through the processes, and it just is not easy, even for when you're within one of the organizations. And I believe that's all I have. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Reynolds. Mr. John Humans?
Yes. Good morning, Madam Chair.
Good morning.
John Humans here, representing the Alaska Service Disabled Small Business Alliance. I think that I'm just going to try to sum up what everyone has said here because it's so important that this bill is passed by me. Again, I must inform you that I've worked for the Veterans Affairs in Anchorage for the past 24 years, and I know that there are so many veterans out there that's not aware of what they're entitled to. Matter of fact, back in the day, probably some of you ladies and gentlemen might remember, but there was a big thing came out where we had so many veterans out in the woods hiding. A lot of those were Vietnam veterans that was out there with their families and didn't want nobody to know where they were or didn't know what they had coming or whatever. And I think it's so important that we get this bill passed so we can get those people informed to know exactly what we, what they have going for themselves. And also, it helps with the VA to help employ people when they're employing people. As you know, we're building a new VA hospital here, and those people are going to need more employees, and that's how you get more employees, by the more veterans that you have. And I would venture to say if once we do a tally on that, we'll have more than the veteran population that they are saying that we have here in Alaska now. So it's very important, and I just, everybody here know, I think, because all of us are veterans and we are dealing with this situation because I'm a member of the American Legion, VFW, DAV, and so on, and I know how many veterans that don't even know where they are in their entitlements. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Anyone else here in the audience that I've overlooked wishing to testify on Senate Bill 278? Anyone else online? Okay, hearing and seeing none, that closes public testimony and brings Senate Bill 278 back before us for a motion. Senator Bundy.
Well, I would just ask the bill sponsor, being we're in agreement, note for the record, we're in agreement.
Yes.
That would the question on the form say, are you a veteran or as defined by having served or been discharged honorably from United States Armed Forces, something that would define veteran as apparently you and I define it, so we could have one common definition.
If the committee feels that's necessary, I certainly wouldn't have any objection to that. What we had envisioned was a question, are you an American military veteran? But if we want to include some sort of provision in there that defines it.
Well, and again, I might say there are foreign nationals that serve in our military, so you might not want to say American, of the American military service would be probably something more that you more likely to be accurate. Well, I don't want to make an amendment on the fly. Is this going to go to finance?
It'll have to have a finance referral.
Well, and rather than hold it up here, I would just recommend that you consider that amendment.
Yes,
and
yes,
finance.
Sir. Thank you.
Senator Green?
Yeah, since this is for purposes of federal response, this definition should coincide with the federal definition.
I would think so.
Thank you.
Okay, and so is the committee comfortable with allowing the definition to be worked on in finance as opposed to holding it over? Okay, I appreciate a motion.
Madam Chair.
Senator French.
I'd be happy to move that we SB 278 be referred out of this committee onto the next committee referral with the attached fiscal notes and individual recommendations.
Okay, is there an objection to that motion? Hearing and seeing none, Senate Bill 278 with individual recommendations and accompanying fiscal note has passed out of Senate State Affairs.
Thank you,
Senator Wilkowski. Next, we have Representative Hawker. Thank you for being so patient, Representative Hawker.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I thank you very kindly for the invitation to appear before you today.
Good morning.
Would you, Madam Chair, for your record keeping, I am Representative Mike Hawker, representing District 32 in Anchorage. House Bill 284 that is before you corrects an inequity that has arisen out of our regulatory interpretation of statute regarding the allowable out-of-state absences and folks still qualifying to receive a current fund dividend. First, to put on the record, I've been very resistive personally to adding new exemptions to the allowable absence statutes. But in this case, I had a constituent come to me a couple of years ago who pointed out that he denied his permanent fund dividend, and he felt that he should qualify in that he was out of state. And I point out our first exemption to the current statutory exemption to the out-of-state residency issue is receiving secondary or post-secondary education on a full-time basis. This very bright young man in my district had been awarded the prestigious Fulbright Fellowship and had spent a year studying in Milan, Italy. Currently, this individual is engaged in his doctoral work down at the University of Southern California and back in the country finishing his education. Well, the rub is in our regulatory process. The regulations say you must be enrolled as a student. Well, when you receive a fellowship, these fellowships are endowed chairs, so you avoid the enrollment process. So to honestly answer the question, were you enrolled? The answer is no. I'm occupying a fellowship chair that I was appointed to by the selection process of the Fulbright. And by terms of our regulation, the answer was, well, then you certainly don't qualify for a permanent fund dividend because you're not enrolled, even though I would point out to the committee, and you'll see it in the bill before us, of course, lists all of the exemptions, but on page one of the bill, section A-1, the legislature's intent when we passed that original exemption said receiving secondary or post-secondary education on a full-time basis. And then item two, the second most important exemption, refined it further where it could be also vocational, professional, or other specific education on a full-time basis. We did take the issue up with the Department of Revenue, who were very sympathetic to the cause, and I believe testimony is on record and can be provided again. The Department of Revenue believes that the Fulbright should be a qualifying exemption, but they ran into problems with the folks that write and interpret regulations and said it's just too difficult to interpret that since we've embarked on this enrollment criteria, and asked us to come back to the legislature with a specific bill to correct the inequity. And that's where we came up with language in the generic that adds the exemption, which in my opinion is clarifying exemption number one no more, that a student participating for educational purposes in a student fellowship sponsored by the United States Department of Education or by the United States Department of State. That is exactly how the Fulbright works. It's a program sanctioned, sponsored, has been since 1946 by the United States Department of State. Again, happy to answer any questions the committee has, but as briefly as I can do it, that's the circumstance. Clarifying what I believe was the intent of original statute and resolving an issue that's arisen out of the regulatory process and correcting what's really nothing more than an inequity.
Okay.
Question?
Senator Green.
Are there any other comparable programs? You hear Rhodes Scholars. I don't know what the others are, but are they comparable to this? And should it maybe not be through?
Madam President, In our ongoing research and through the previous record of testimony, that same question has arisen, and in particular in relation to those other scholarship programs, when we ask that, well, maybe we need to expand it more, we've continued to find that those programs do currently qualify under our existing regulatory structure. It's this unique aspect of the Fulbright Fellowship that we have run afoul of. So we have not at this point found any other programs that have come to our attention that would have a similar problem.
Interesting. Senator Bundy.
Thank you. You mentioned endowed chairs. That often, at least in our university system, indicates someone who's working for a salary. But in this indication, incidents, are they both teaching and enrolled, or worse, they're not enrolled, but are they both teachers and students?
Through the chair, Madam McGuire, Senator Bundy, sir. As the testimony from the students I'm familiar with, these were student fellowships. They were not teaching fellowships. They were not compensated activities. Unfortunately, the young man who represents, that we represent, is on of his education in Southern California, I believe prohibits him from being available, and I don't know, we may have a Juneau person, with apologies, who is also trapped in this web, but their previous testimony indicated that they were simply working, in students, these were not research chairs that were compensated.
Yeah, thank you.
Further questions, Senator Green.
Okay, I just want to be sure that the 3 months to 1 year, is the 3 months adequately covered in here? Because most of them are full-time or 15 hours or, representing a 9-month at least stay. But this is outside of that?
Madam Chair, President Green, I'm missing the point of your question, but if you're looking at the duration of these fellowships can be anywhere from a number of months to upwards of a year that I'm familiar with here.
Okay, earlier in the statute, Madam Chair, it says, and I just want to be sure this is outside of it, receiving secondary or post-secondary education on a full-time basis. And I just want to be sure that doesn't countermand reference number 16. Maybe I'm reading it wrong.
Well, I think Senator Green, that the idea is to get around it, to even just get out of that whole web of qualification and enrollment and simply make a specific allowance
for the
fellowship.
And Madam Chair, consistent with the intent of that original statute, the persons participating on the Fulbright, these are full-time activities, full-time students. This is not a part-time activity.
Okay. Further questions? Senator Bundy.
Well, just a comment. If it's less than 3 months, they aren't disqualified from PFD anyway. You get the 90-day absence. That's a freebie.
That's right.
And
well,
okay.
Madam Chair.
Senator Green.
Yeah. Well, I am having a hard time, comporting what is in the statute with the regulation that requires enrolled. And I would suggest that you, as chair of the Regulatory Review Committee, review that language.
I will. We're corresponding on that issue. It's interesting, and we can talk, Jerry and I. Okay, Senator French.
Madam Chair, before we conclude, I feel like we're getting ready to wrap up, and I wanted to, if I could, distribute an amendment to the members of the committee so we'd have time to think about it between now and the next committee meeting.
Okay.
It's, if I could, Sean, thanks.
Madam Chair, well,
Senator
that's being
Bundy.
Distributed. Just a question for the bill sponsor. Part in line 16 or line 30, item 16, participate in educational purposes in a student fellowship. That's assumed to be full time. Fellowships are not granted for part time study, are they?
Madam Chairman, Representative Senator Bundy. In this case, I'm not aware of any that would be part-time that would be caught up here, but again, this was specifically looking at those student fellowships sponsored by the Department of Education, by the Department of State, and I'm unaware of any of those that involve a part-time activity.
Okay. And so we have amendment number one, Senator French.
Madam Chair, I move amendment number one.
Object.
Okay, there's an objection. You want to speak about your amendment?
Sure. I appreciate the sponsor, framing this bill as an opportunity to correct an inequity, and I think that's the exact same motivation behind this amendment, which corrects the inequity present in exception number 14, which allows a Peace Corps volunteer to be gone from the state and collect a permanent fund dividend, but does not allow an AmeriCorps volunteer to be gone from the state and correct the same thing.
Shalon is making a copy, by the way.
I have a copy right here. I'm sorry. As I think it has been pointed out in another debate on this topic, if you are a Peace Corps volunteer working in Tijuana, Mexico, you can get a permanent fund dividend. But if you're an AmeriCorps volunteer working in just across the border in the United States of America, you can't. And so I think that's an inequity that we at least need to have a committee discussion on at the next hearing. And so I wanted to advance the idea for the time being, let folks do their own research on AmeriCorps. I'll have more information about the program when we come back, but I wanted to get folks thinking about it before we meet again.
Senator French, any idea on numbers of people?
I'll have that information when we appear next.
Okay.
Madam Chair?
Yes, Representative Hawker.
If I might, this same amendment was introduced on the floor of the House of Representatives. At that point, there was also no particular understanding of exactly what the AmeriCorps program was, what the scope might entail, and we did not adopt the amendment at that time. And I frankly, again, I had asked because it was one of those situations where it did merit its evaluation on its own merits, and there is now a separate bill fully, completely introduced in the House of Representatives that exactly accomplishes what this amendment would attempt to do with this bill.
Okay. Senator Bundy, and then Stevens, and then French.
And our next meeting, I would want to hear from the PFD people about the impact of this amendment.
Okay.
If there is one.
Senator Stevens.
Madam Chair, I'm not at all familiar with America. I have no idea what it is. And so if the maker of the motion amendment could provide us with a little background information, it would be helpful.
We'll deliver a packet.
Senator French.
Okay, last question. Do you support that bill?
Madam Chair, I don't frankly have enough information to know whether I do or do not support the AmeriCorps bill. If it rises to the same standard as this bill is, I would be very happy to see that bill moving through as well, correcting an inequity. Again, as you all know, these sort of bills, Madam Chair, you have a great deal of experience with these.
Yes, I do.
And in sincerely, it's one of the arguments is I believe each of these issues should be addressed separately, individually, on its own merits, so we avoid the what we proverbially refer to as the Christmas tree effect on these, where we all have some dog in the fight. And I would ask this committee to recognize these Fulbright students and that it has very clearly been something that they brought to the legislative process fully, fairly, participating as members of our community, helped and support introducing legislation in the process. And, you know, while we know there are many number of techniques to increase the scope of legislation, but in this case, I think the public would be, particularly the young students involved, would be best served by keeping this bill free of the additional amendment at this time, which, again, it can move as rapidly through the legislative process as we have tried to move this particular issue.
Okay, and so Representative Hawker, out of respect for members of the Senate who's offered an amendment, I will allow this to carry over to the next Senate State Affairs meeting, and you'll be at the top of the agenda. So that's your timeline, Senator French, and no disrespect to you. Representative Hawker will get you first up on the next meeting, which will be Thursday, March the 13th. We'll put you up first on the agenda. So you both have your work cut out for you, respectively. Senator French.
And just in closing, I mean no disrespect to the bill sponsor. I know how I would feel if this were happening to me on the other side, but I think this is a natural sort of outgrowth of the 90-day session that requires us to be as efficient as possible when time comes to look for opportunities to do the right thing in sometimes a manner that's, more efficient.
Understood. Senator Bundy.
I think I would stipulate accurately that the bill sponsor was not a strong proponent of the 90-day session. Probably shouldn't be punished for it.
That's actually a very good point. Irony.
Nor I.
Okay, and so thank you, Representative Hawker, and we will see you again Thursday, or your staff, and we are adjourned.
Thank you, Madam Chair.